From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump has signed the budget agreement that Congress passed just before sunrise in Washington this morning, ending an hours-long freeze in federal spending. Now the question is, will lawmakers come together on a measure to protect young immigrants whose deportation protections expire next month? Immigration is expected to come up for debate next week.
Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Joining us today, Enrique Acevedo, Univision News anchor. He's in Miami. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. He's in Washington. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there. And with the cold here, I'm jealous.
You're jealous that we all wish we were in Miami today, Enrique. Well, in Washington, where you are, Domenico, 73 House Democrats bucked their leadership and joined Republicans in voting for the Senate's two-year budget agreement, even though it did not address immigration. And we're going to get to that. 167 Republicans voted yes for the deal, even though the plan is going to add more to the debt. What stood out to you about how this unfolded?
Well, the fact that they had a lot of this negotiating going on behind the scenes, and the fact that Chuck Schumer was willing to hold the line on DACA and shut the government down not that long ago and now decided not to this time around and go with some of these broader priorities here. Now, there's still a lot to go when it goes to the House, because a lot of Republicans, a lot of conservatives don't like the fact that this thing would increase the debt, because it adds another $400 billion in spending. So, you know, on top of $1.5 trillion in tax cuts, another $400 billion here, that's gotten a lot of people on the right, as we saw all through last night, very concerned and upset.
Enrique, your thoughts about that? Because it didn't seem like there was a problem raising the debt when the tax cut came along.
Right. They were not concerned about deficits then.
Deficits,
yeah. I'm just worried that Congress can't pass legislation supported by 80% of Americans, legislation like the DREAM Act, but manages to shut down the federal government twice in a few weeks. Our political system was designed to let majorities rule. People are entitled to get from government whatever a majority of them want. And that should be a central determiner of legislation and policy. But it seems like time and time again, a radical minority in Congress is forcing its agenda on the majority. And that is not what it means to live in a democracy.
Well, do you believe, Enrique, that they are going to address the Dreamers before the deadline in March?
I think they will find a solution in Congress. I'm just not very optimistic that they will do it by the deadline, Jeremy. Hmm.
Let's listen to Senator Rand Paul, Kentucky senator, who held up voting in the Senate last night with a talkathon warning about deficit spending.
I ran for office because I was very critical of President Obama's trillion-dollar deficits. Now we have Republicans hand-in-hand with Democrats offering us trillion-dollar deficits. I can't, in all good honesty and all good faith, just look the other way because my party is now complicit in the deficits.
And as Meghna mentioned, Rand Paul voted for the $1.5 trillion tax cut along with a number of other Republicans. This is his fellow Republican John Cornyn criticizing what he did last night.
The senator from Kentucky, by objecting to the unanimous consent request, will effectively shut down the federal government for no real reason. I know he wants to make a point. He has that right. I agree with many of his concerns about deficits and debt. But we are an emergency situation.
Domenico, what did you make of Rand Paul's move there when it didn't even stop the bill from passing in the end?
Yeah, he wants to be able to take a stand and make a point in the same way that Nancy Pelosi wanted to make a point the day before with her eight-hour speech, the longest speech in House history since at least 1909. She wanted to make a point on DACA and the fact that there was nothing in this budget deal having to do with that. And Rand Paul wanted to make a point in saying that nobody has done anything when it comes to the debt, whichever party it is. And that's a perfect message for Rand Paul's brand. I mean, this is a guy who won being able to say, I have a message from the Tea Party. And the message from the Tea Party was shrink and reduce what the government is spending on so that you bring the debt down. And that hasn't worked since that 2010 wave.
Hmm. You know, Enrique, I wonder what you think of this. It seems to me that President Trump actually, in a tweet this morning, may have been the most transparent of them all, right? Because he talked about how Republicans were forced to increase domestic spending, quote, on things we do not like or want. I mean, that's kind of fundamentally what it comes down to. It doesn't matter what party is. People are going to spend federal dollars on what they want, and they're going to complain about spending federal dollars on things they don't want.
Well, that's actually one of the advantages Donald Trump has as a politician. He's not tied to a particular ideology or any convictions for that matter. So he doesn't have to run on one particular promise, you know, even though he made a lot of them during the campaign. What I'm saying is he's not concerned about catering to a particular group, I think, on this specific discussion about the budget.
How much trouble is White House Chief of Staff John Kelly in, Domenico, after his aide Rob Porter abruptly left his job as staff secretary on Wednesday amid this domestic violence allegations that became public this week? Let's listen here to one of Porter's ex-wives, Jennifer Willoughby, speaking with Anderson Cooper on CNN last night.
He is a intelligent, kind, chivalrous, caring, professional man, and he is deeply troubled and angry and violent. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive.
And the people he works with may not have seen that side of him at all.
Of course not. Of course not.
Now, it turns out reports are saying that Kelly and the White House counsel Don McGahn were told months ago about these allegations as part of Porter's vetting for a security clearance. What do you make of this story, Domenico?
Well, there's reports that the president is upset with everyone from John Kelly to Hope Hicks, who he said or has told some reporters have reported that that the president's been upset with, that he felt that Hope Hicks's relationship with Porter had clouded her judgment. There have been reports that he's upset with John Kelly and isn't sure what he's going to do, and that he may have called Reince Priebus, his former chief of staff, who he had ousted to hire Kelly in the first place. So there's all kinds of turmoil going on within the White House today. We don't know if that's just the president and how he feels this morning, or if he is going to continue to feel that way. But there's certainly going to be a lot of questions from reporters at the briefing today and throughout this week on who knew what, when, and what was relayed to the president and what wasn't. Because so far, that hasn't been very forthcoming from the White House. So I think that that's a big piece of it. I want to make one point about the last question that you asked about the president talking about government waste and the spending, because it's part of this whole story. But kind of what drives Trump, and it was so nakedly honest for him to say that government is essentially, you know, whatever you spend on domestic money is wasteful, and whatever is spent for military is good spending. That's not usually the way you hear conservatives talk about it. They talk about waste and good governance and managing the government better. But this is a whole different world of both parties kind of going in different directions when it comes to how they spend money.
Enrique, go ahead.
On Kelly, I would just add that, you know, President Trump and his chief of staff have much more in common than people think. I thought it was revealing how even after Kelly recognized Rob Porter's behavior, he still didn't mention the victims of his alleged abuse. The same with Dreamers. He suggested some of them were lazy for not applying to DACA when the White House he manages has done everything to prove those kids that decided to withhold their personal information from their government right. I still believe Kelly is a positive force inside a chaotic administration, but instead of Kelly changing the Trump White House, it seems the White House is changing him.
The vice president has been in Asia for the Olympics, and in Japan, on his way to the Olympics, reporters pressed him on the Porter story, and here's what he said to Washington Post reporter Ashley Parker.
We'll comment on any issues affecting White House staff when we get back to Washington.
Briefly follow up on that and ask, this is now a number of times when you found out, you're the vice president, you're number two in the administration, where you found out about something very late after a number of other senior staff below you, even in the West Wing, have found out about it. Again, I understand we're standing here, but can you comment on why you often seem a little bit out of the loop on some of this major news?
You know, it's a great honor for me to serve as vice president. And President Trump has been incredibly generous with the responsibilities.
Domenico, what do you make of that? It does seem like Mike Pence seems to be out of the way when stuff like this happens.
You know, Jeremy, it's a great honor for me to be on this.
Everyone genuflect. 1, 2, 3.
I mean, I think that Mike Pence, going all the way back to the Mike Flynn situation, where the former national security advisor, you know, essentially told Pence the wrong information, lied to the vice president. The vice president wound up going on Sunday shows with the wrong information. You know, Mike Pence is Mike Pence. He has his own way of being. Certainly, it's very different than President Trump's. He's going out there to do a job and to try to do what's what's best he feels for the president, but he's clearly not always in the loop.
You know, all along, as we've had story after story from the Trump administration, President Trump has been able to point out that the stock market's doing really well. And I'm just noticing, again, we're seeing it down today. We read that it's lost 40% of its value that it gained under President Trump so far. Enrique, just in the few seconds we have left, is this going to be a big story, what's happening in the stock market?
I hope not, because it eventually might hurt the real economy. And I think it's a rocky mistake by the president to link himself to the markets right. in that very public way.
That's Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision. We've also been speaking with Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Starting next year, there will no longer be a federal individual mandate to have health insurance in the United States. That mandate was part of President Obama's Affordable Care Act. And while Republicans failed to repeal the Affordable Care Act as a whole, they did succeed in repealing the individual mandate in their tax bill. However, a number of states are now considering their own individual mandates, and one of them is Maryland. And Maryland State Senator Jim Rosa Pep is one of the co-sponsors of a new plan there. He's a Democrat and joins us from Annapolis. Senator Rosa Pep, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So it seems as if Maryland is considering some pretty innovative things when it comes to coming up with a new kind of individual mandate. First of all, you're not going to fine people directly if they don't have health insurance. What do you propose to do instead?
We're proposing a down payment on health insurance. The purpose of the Affordable Care Act was to get more people health insurance and make it more affordable for more people. That was the whole point. And so what we're saying is, instead of having a mandate where someone, if they don't do it, pays a penalty and the money goes to the defense budget or something else, that they make a down payment if they haven't bought health insurance, they make a down payment on their next year's health insurance. So the money goes towards actually giving them health insurance. That's good for them. But as importantly, it's good for everybody else who has insurance on an individual basis, farmers, carpenters, real estate agents, other people who are self-employed. If we don't pass this down payment plan, we think 10% of the people in Maryland will get huge increases in health insurance premiums.
Yeah. So if the state is asking them or requiring them to pay a down payment on a future health insurance plan, it's still making them buy insurance. What about for the folks who just don't want to have it?
Folks don't want to have insurance. They can contribute to everybody else's insurance. I mean, it obviously doesn't make sense, but if people want to do that, they can do that. Mm. The big picture, though, is this is not mostly about the small number of people who don't want insurance. Most people want insurance. But the bigger impact is on all the other people who buy insurance on their own in the individual market, the self-employed, whose rates will go way up if we don't make sure that as many people as possible are buying health insurance.
I see. Now, there's something else that you're proposing that's very interesting to me, that essentially the state could begin playing a bigger role in helping consumers shop for insurance, that that basically the state could match uninsured customers into $0 premium plans. Tell me more
right.
about that.
If someone has not bought health insurance during the open enrollment period on the health care exchange, which we've had for a number of years under the Affordable Care Act, come tax time, when they file their taxes, it'll say, you owe this amount of money, and if you want this to go to health insurance for yourself, check here. That information would go from our state controller's office to the state health care exchange, and they would match that person up with a health care plan they could buy with just the money they otherwise would have paid in penalty to the federal government.
I see.
So it makes it much more efficient. We also think that we're going to find a lot of people who are eligible for Medicaid. So people don't think about these things until they need to. That's obviously the problem. Mm-hmm. And so the easier we make it for people, this is sort of part of the behavioral economics movement, is make people's bad habits, delay, procrastination, work for their health instead of against their health.
Yeah. About the state helping choose the insurance plan, though, first of all, just quickly, it would be an opt-in or an opt-out kind of thing?
Well, it would be opt-in in the sense that if you checked the box and said, I want health insurance for this money, instead of just losing the money, it's opt-in.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense.
Okay.
So nobody's being forced to do anything. But the critical thing is that if people don't choose a plan we would put them into a plan that they can afford based on what they've already paid.
Right.
They can always opt out if they want to.
I heard you say that you're not going to ask people to spend any more. It's based on what they've spent before in their health care. But even within that, there's a lot of different options within plans.
Well, actually, the healthcare exchange believes that it can find the plan that would provide the most coverage at the lowest out-of-pocket cost for the amount of the premium that they already would pay in a penalty if they don't do the down payment. It actually is easier than you would think it would be. We'll also give people the option, if they want to say, pay a little bit more money and get a plan with lower deductibles and lower copays. So they would have options to get better plans, but they would be put into the one they would get for no additional cost.
I see. I'm curious. We were looking at a poll from the Urban Institute that said about 20% of Democrats actually supported repealing the individual mandate. I'm just wondering, what's your sense about, do people in Maryland want a return of the mandate?
I think people want health insurance, and they want to get health insurance affordably and easily. And they want to make sure not just that their neighbors have affordable health insurance, but that they have affordable health insurance. And that's why I come back to the point. The biggest beneficiaries of this down payment plan will not be the people who get health insurance for the first time. It will be the farmers, the real estate agents, the other self-employed people, which is about 10% of our workforce, whose rates will go through the roof if we don't pass this down payment plan.
Right. Well, last question for you, if I may. Governor Larry Hogan, a Republican of Maryland, has basically called the plan or the proposal a tax, and he said he wants an approach that has more incentives. It seems as if you don't have the governor's full support yet. Is that a problem?
He hadn't talked to me about it. The issue, I think, is this is an incentive. The federal government said you'll pay a penalty if you don't have health insurance. We're proposing a down payment on your own health insurance.
Well, Maryland State Senator Jim Rosapep speaking to us from Annapolis. Thank you so very much.
Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you.
Three decades ago, Gallup, New Mexico was nicknamed Drunk Town USA. For many years, the city ranked number one in the country for the number of alcohol-related deaths. Gallup borders the Navajo Nation and has worked hard to save lives and change that image. But as Laurel Morales from KJZZ's Fronteras desk reports, there's still a lot of work to be done.
McKinley County Commissioner Genevieve Jackson grew up on the edge of the Navajo Nation, not far from Gallup. Like many Navajos, Jackson's mother came to Gallup to buy alcohol. Jackson says her mother often wound up passed out on the streets.
Whenever it was announced on the radio that an unidentified woman's body was found, I was just in fear. It was almost a relief that it wasn't her, but then another body would be found.
The Navajo Nation prohibits the sale of alcohol, but Jackson says that doesn't stop Navajos from buying from bootleggers or drinking in border towns like Gallup. This time of year, community service aides drive around Gallup looking for drinkers who have passed out on the street and are at risk of freezing to death. Back in the 1980s, the police used to handle that task. They'd pick up as many as 200 people a day and bring them to the drunk tank, as it was called. It had a cement floor and a drain. Kevin Foley says people took turns sleeping on the floor.
In the morning, they would open up this big garage door, and whoever could walk out, there'd be a big, long parade of people walking down to Cole Street,
where there were several bars or liquor stores to choose from. Today, Kevin Foley says alcoholics come here to Nat Nahoji, a detox center where they're given a bed, food, and counseling for up to 3 days. Foley is the executive director of the facility. With 26,000 admissions every year, it's the nation's busiest treatment center with many repeat clients. And that's 10,000 fewer people than the drunk tank had 3 decades ago. When someone is serious about quitting booze, they check into the residential program across the street. That's what Freddie Smith Jr. did. He's been sober 8 months. Smith, who is Navajo, says he started partying as a teenager and quickly became an alcoholic and a meth addict on the reservation.
There's no real opportunities or anything. I just kind of just lost hope, I think. Nothing big to look forward to, and I started drinking regularly.
Native American youth have the highest rates of alcoholism of any racial group in the country, according to the National Institutes of Health. Studies suggest high rates of addiction in Indian country stem from 2 decades of cultural destruction and violence. Half of the Navajo tribe is unemployed. After Smith stole a car and hit bottom, he told his probation officer he was ready to get sober. He came to NCI, where they have medicine men on staff. They use traditional Native American methods like drumming, sweat lodge, and tobacco ceremonies.
Kind of like a form of meditation and prayer. There's a lot of power behind those songs and prayers, and hits you deep inside.
This detox center is the result of a major group effort in 1989. After a string of fatal alcohol-related accidents, more than 200 people marched from Gallup to the capital, Santa Fe, to ask state lawmakers for help. David Conejo led that effort. Today, he's the hospital's CEO.
The people in the street, we can step over them, or we can do something about it.
In the end, Gallup received enough federal funds to open NCI, $400,000 from the Indian Health Service. And the city also changed its laws. No more drive-up liquor store windows, no liquor is sold on Sundays, and McKinley County became the first county in the state to approve a liquor excise tax that provides $600,000 a year for abuse prevention and education. Today, Freddie Smith Jr. is an artist and a behavioral health tech for NCI. He brings people into detox, pats them down for weapons or contraband, and shows them to their bed.
I tell them, you know, hey, I was heading the same, you know, in the same path you were, and look where I'm at. I'm not, you know, oh, you think you're better than me? It's like, no, it's not. It's just, you can help yourself. It's all up to you. If you need help, instead, ask for it. Don't be afraid. Because that's what I was doing. I think I was afraid.
The number of people freezing to death has dropped significantly in McKinley County, but the number of alcohol-related deaths from both diseases and accidents is still 3 times the national average. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Morales.
You have access to the entire world of NPR with your smart speaker. Ask it to play NPR or your local NPR station to check the news while you get ready for work or fix dinner. There's a new radio in your house, and it's easier than ever to listen to Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and more. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your local NPR station.
In the new film, The 1517 to Paris, director Clint Eastwood cast 3 real-life heroes to play themselves on the big screen. We spoke to the 3 of them yesterday, and we'll link you to that conversation at hereandnow.org. As NPR contributor Andrew Lapin reports, having real-life heroes play themselves in a movie is part of a Hollywood tradition.
In 2015, 3 Americans vacationing in Europe helped subdue a gunman on a high-speed train traveling from Amsterdam to Paris. The whole thing was over in seconds, but their bravery and quick thinking likely averted a massacre. Spencer Stone, an off-duty Air Force staff sergeant, and Alex Gerlatos, a National Guard specialist, together with their childhood friend Anthony Sadler, were awarded the French Legion of Honor and numerous American medals for valor. And now they're getting the creme de la creme of heroes' tributes. The 1517 to Paris is a movie about them, starring them, and focusing on the moments leading up to their heroic act. Director Clint Eastwood has Stone, Scarlatos, and Sadler reenact that daring takedown on board the Thales train, this time with some added sense of destiny thrown in, as in this scene where they share a quiet moment in a cafe.
Wait, what'd you say?
I don't know, man. It's something I said in Venice. I was caught up in that European high, I'm not gonna lie.
Nah. You should have heard this guy. He was talking about how life is catapulting him towards something, like some greater purpose or something like that.
Spencer said that.
I know, right?
By casting real-life heroes in a movie as themselves, Eastwood is picking up on a Hollywood tradition that dates back to World War II. That was when director William Wyler met Harold Russell, an Army veteran who lost both his hands while making a training film. Wyler himself had made films on the front lines, and he cast Russell in the 1945 drama The Best Years of Our Lives as a vet named Homer who struggles with his disability at home. In one scene, he takes his girlfriend through his bedtime routine.
This is when I know I'm helpless. My hands are down there on the bed. I can't put them on again without calling to somebody for help. I can't smoke a cigarette or read a book. If that door should blow shut, I can't open it and get out of this room. I'm as dependent as a baby that doesn't know how to get anything except cry for it. Well, now you know, Wilma. Now you have an idea of what it is.
Russell had no acting experience, but his performance was so heartbreaking that he won 2 Oscars for the role, Best Supporting Actor, and an honorary award for bringing hope to other veterans. He's the only actor in history to win two Oscars for the same performance. Oh, and the film took Best Picture, too. 10 years later, Audie Murphy made his screen debut. Murphy was one of the most decorated combat veterans of all time, and he played himself in the World War II film To Hell and Back.
We'll never be able to stay here with 30 men. Put them on back seating time with A Company.
What about you?
I'm going to stay here and see if I can get some artillery working.
So there were big differences between how Russell and Murphy were used in the movies. Russell got to be the everyman, a symbol of the human cost of combat. He was allowed to be complex and vulnerable on screen, even if for only one movie. But Murphy? He was Hollywood's new leading man, a handsome champion of American values. And the military saw him as a recruiting tool, even if that meant having him relive the battles that first gave him PTSD. Our new trio is a little of both. Every man who becomes Superman when the moment calls for it. One of the things that movies have the power to do is reenact real-life trauma. But here, Eastwood is giving Stone, Skarlatos, and Sadler the chance to help shape their own legends. And who wouldn't want to take that train? For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Lapin.
The federal government is back open after a brief shutdown overnight. Republicans and Democrats agreed to a deal that hikes federal spending by about $400 billion. Many in Congress are worried about adding so much to the debt. Yesterday, we heard from economist Stephanie Kelton, who said fears about deficit spending are misplaced. Today, we're going to hear a counterpoint from Maya McGuinness, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. I spoke with her before the vote in Washington, and I started by asking what she thought of the budget deal.
This is most certainly anything but a responsible budget. So first, obviously, it's coming one-third of the way through the year, which is just a sign of how incredibly broken our budgeting process is at this point. But we have near record debt levels in this country. We are approaching trillion-dollar deficits every year, looking out forever. And what Congress is about to do is have a huge budget-busting plan that's going to add much more to the deficit at a time that that will be bad for the economy and certainly bad for the fiscal health of the country. And it's all because they're unwilling to make any hard choices, it appears.
Do you believe that a balanced budget is the right approach, or can we have some level of debt each year in the United States?
Yeah, I don't think we need a balanced budget at all. I think what you want to do is balance the budget over the business cycle so that you have a healthy fiscal situation. And when the economy is strong, like it is now, you might want to be running surpluses so that you can borrow a lot when you have an economic downturn or a national disaster. And then you don't need to worry about deficits. But what you don't want to do is have structural deficits, which means we borrow every single year during good times and bad times, just because, frankly, nobody's willing to pay the bills. So it's not about balancing the budget, but it most certainly is about making sure that your debt's not growing faster than your economy. And that's the situation that we have right now, which is really quite damaging.
Republicans would say, and they did say, that maybe there will be greater revenue coming in because of their $1.5 trillion tax cut package, that those tax cuts might pay for themselves. Where do you stand on that?
That's just not true. There was a lot of discussion around the tax bill about whether tax cuts pay for themselves, and there's no question they do not. Tax cuts do grow the economy, but they don't grow it enough to make up for the lost revenue. And the problem with the tax bill that was passed, and I say this as someone who thinks tax reform was a very important priority we should have pursued, but because it was huge tax cuts, all the growth that was going to be generated from improving the tax code could be undermined by the increased levels of debt. So if you want pro-growth tax reform, which is what we should have had, we needed to offset it by getting rid of the over $1 trillion a year in tax breaks that we have. But once again, sort of demonstrating that politicians right now are not making hard choices. They did the tax cuts part, and they just dropped the reform part.
As you know, there are many economists who disagree with you and believe in some sense that deficits don't matter. Let's listen to one of them that we spoke with yesterday, economist Stephanie Kelton.
So you hear people say things like your share of the national debt, you know, every man, woman and child owes $60,000 in debt. This is really silly because the federal government's debt is not our obligation. It's not our liability. In fact, the federal government's debt is nothing more than the U.S. Treasury bonds that lots of people hold in their portfolios, and they consider them not their liabilities, but their assets.
What do you say to that argument?
If that were really true, then it would be great because we could spend more and more and we could cut taxes more and more and it would just be great for the economy. So when something sounds too good to be true, it is true. The problem, of course, with increasing debt is that, one, it slows the economy. Two, it means that your interest payments in the budget are growing. And right now, our interest payments are one of the very fastest growing areas of the budget. So whether you're absolutely conservative and you want to cut taxes, or you're very progressive and you want to increase spending, if that money's going to interest payments, that is not money well spent. And ultimately, the excessive levels of debt lead to slower growth, which leads to a lower standard of living in the country. And so it's not as though the debt collector is going to come and say, you have to pay up on your share of the debt today. But it does mean that we are completely hamstringing ourselves, both during recessions, but also the next generation when they want to figure out how to direct their own resources in the budget. And we've committed so much, certainly to a bunch of programs, but also to the interest payments on all the spending that we decided we didn't want to pay for. So it's an incredibly short-sighted and unfair approach. And it's damaging to us and it's damaging to the future.
Well, you say that higher levels of debt can lead to slower growth. Couldn't a reduction in debt and maybe a cut in spending also lead to slower growth?
It depends on where you are in the business cycle, but a reduction in debt is overall going to lead to higher levels of growth. When
Why?
You look at the models, what it shows, because it frees up more resources in the economy that are invested in productive ways. So if you put in place a debt deal, what the models tend to show, and it depends, again, where you are in the business cycle, it would have a negative effect on growth for a few years and then a positive effect on growth forever thereafter. So in many ways, I just think this reflects the short-sightedness of our political system right now and therefore our policies as a result. Where if we were putting in place a medium or long-term comprehensive economic growth plan, which is what this country needs, a sound fiscal policy would be a part of it.
Do you think that in times of crisis, like the financial crisis that we had many years ago, that it makes sense to deficit spend?
I do. And I think that's exactly why you want to have a healthy fiscal situation, so that when you have a downturn or an emergency, you're not constrained and you're able to borrow to help stimulate the economy and deal with the contractionary effects that are going on from the recession. So in 2008, last time we had trillion-dollar deficits, that was a necessity. People can fight over whether the stimulus we had was the right or wrong stimulus, but it was really critical that we were able to borrow to respond to that crisis. And our debt relative to the economy back then was half of what it is today. So right now we're about to have trillion-dollar deficits completely self-imposed, not as the result of a downturn, but just as a result of not paying for things. That will make the next downturn, when again we should be borrowing, much more challenging to deal with.
Does it feel like you're fighting a losing battle right now? You're talking about a responsible federal budget. And we've been through a few months in the last few months when we've added hundreds of billions of dollars to the debt.
We're losing this at every opportunity to do something right. So we should have done comprehensive tax reform that it was either revenue neutral or preferably raised revenues. And now we should be doing a budget deal where we figure out what our spending priorities are and how to pay for those and how to reduce spending instead of increasing it. Though I would argue that we need to figure out the smart places for savings. We've been saving in all the wrong places in the past years. Instead, they opt to borrow more. And it's as though the only thing that gets done in a bipartisan manner right now, and the tax bill wasn't bipartisan, that was Republicans. But on the spending side, it seems like the only way you get a deal is one side says, well, I want this and not pay for it. And the other side says, okay, as long as I get this and not pay for it. And that is not a functioning government.
Well, are you surprised that Republicans haven't stepped up and said, we're really concerned, with the exception of some, like the House Freedom Caucus, but others have not gotten up there and said, we're concerned about this deficit?
Well, I think after we passed this huge tax bill that did blow up the deficit, it becomes harder for people to credibly, who voted for the tax bill, talk about how much they care about the deficit and debt. But I would have expected more of them to say, we don't want to spend more. Because there's two different points. There are those of us, and I put myself here, who care very much about the deficit and the debt and making sure that it makes sense for the economy. And it's not about bigger or smaller government. But even if you've kind of walked away from that issue, and I don't think we should have, there are a lot of Republicans who've been very committed to lower spending levels. So I'm certainly quite shocked to see how many of them seem to be on the verge of voting for a huge increase in spending.
And what do you make of the polling that shows that just under half of Americans now think that deficit and debt should be a top priority, compared with two-thirds of Americans just a few years ago?
Oh, I think that there's no question that this is an issue that doesn't move forward on the national agenda or get the kind of support it needs unless you have leadership from the top. And that means you have to have a president and you have to have members of Congress from both parties who are explaining just kind of directly to American voters why the short-term pleasure of not paying for anything ends up harming the economy in the longer run. And we don't have those voices right now talking about fiscal responsibility out of our political leaders from anywhere. And so if you keep telling people, you can have a free lunch, deficits don't matter, it's a pretty nice thing to grab onto and hope that it's true. But I think it's going to lead us to a pretty dismal situation down the road when all of this kind of we have to deal with the fiscal reckoning of having overborrowed for so long.
It's Maya McGuinness, who is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Maya, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
After a tumultuous few weeks, the Los Angeles Times has a new owner, billionaire Patrick Soon-Shiong. Could that bring stability to the major newspaper? They've had a lot of troubles. The latest ones began when its publisher, Ross Levinson, was accused of sexual harassment. In January, the staff of the paper voted to form a union. Newsweek is also making separate headlines with a massive round of firing there on Monday and ongoing troubles at that company. Joining us now with his view on all of these stories is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi there, David.
Hey there.
Okay, so let's talk about this LA Times story. It's a really big one. What's the latest happening at that paper, and could this new owner make a big difference there?
I think it could. The Los Angeles Times is returning to local ownership for the first time in almost two decades. Patrick Soon-Shiong is a billionaire a number of times over, a physician, surgeon, entrepreneur, a minority owner of the Los Angeles Lakers, a philanthropist, somebody who I think has committed publicly to the idea of a conventional, traditional sense of journalism and public interest that a number of folks who voted in favor of unionizing at the LA Times just last month felt was under siege under the new ownership put in place, not just the ownership of Trunk, but the new leadership put in place by that parent company. Trunk decided to sort of wash its hands of the problem after we had raised questions about past allegations of workplace misconduct and two lawsuits involving sexual harassment in which the publisher of the LA Times was named a defendant. They finally said this is just too much issue. They'd mutinied against their editor-in-chief. It looks like it could be a new day for the LA Times, but there are questions about that owner too.
So what are some of the questions then?
Well, you know, even with the esteem with which Dr. Soon-Shiong is held by many, there are questions about ways in which he has operated in the past, questions about some of the definitions of an arrangement he had in funding a clinic at the University of Utah, whether in some ways it had been written to redound to the benefit of one of his companies. The very highly respected Boston-based health news organization Stat News had done a deep dive on Soon-Shiong and some of his efforts in favor of what's being called the moonshot, that is an effort at a cure for cancer, and said that a lot of his claims were hyped up or inflated or unsubstantiated for what he was going to be able to accomplish or what he had accomplished. And he's said to be very thin-skinned about journalistic criticism of some of his efforts in the past. The question is whether that's a particularly good characteristic for a publisher. But at the moment, let me just say a lot of folks in the newsroom are breathing a sigh of relief and are very hopeful for the leadership under his tenure. Oh. They just don't know who he's going to put in place to lead them.
Right. Very interesting, because, you know, you mentioned that that note or that letter that he wrote to the LA Times staff, talking a little bit about himself and his view of journalism, because he wrote, as someone who grew up in apartheid South Africa, I understand the role that journalism needs to play in a free society.
Yeah. And it that really struck a chord. You know, one of the real rankling points for folks at the LA Times in recent months was the appointment of Louis Dvorkin, past editor of Forbes and a person who had some stints at the at Newsweek and the New York Times and Wall Street Journal along the way, but sort of talked about his investment emotionally in journalism through referring to various Hollywood films about journalism as opposed to talking with passion about the work and the traditions of the Los Angeles Times, a place that has won, I believe, 44 Pulitzers in its history and has done a lot of, you know, agenda-setting reporting for Los Angeles, Southern California, and the West. So, you know, there's a place that has had national and international distinction in its coverage, and he didn't seem to be able to tap into those traditions, those aspirations, those ambitions for its journalists there. I think Soon Shiong is signaling he gets that, and that's a real sign of hope.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to talk about Newsweek, that's suffering from a deficit of hope right now, right? Because a number of top editors fired this week, writers, advertisers, executives all jumping ship. I mean, how much longer can Newsweek hang on?
You know, there was a very compelling and moving letter of resignation sent from the distinguished longtime political journalist Matthew Cooper. And he wrote a letter of resignation he posted on his Facebook page. And he said he wasn't sure that there was a Newsweek left to resign from. They had fired their editor-in-chief, their executive editor, early this week along with one of their top reporters. And it appeared to be because those folks were involved in investigating, holding accountable their parent company and their ownership for deep problems, questions of their finances. I believe there had been a raid on Newsweek by law enforcement authorities trying to determine whether or not there had been improprieties there. No charges yet, but nonetheless a disturbing sign for any newsroom. You know, you saw these firings happen because they were trying to do the kind of reporting that you would hope the New York Times would do if there were serious questions raised about its operations or the kind of truth-telling we try to do at NPR when there are questions raised here. Newsweek's ownership wasn't having it, people were forced out of result, and you've seen just a flood of resignations. And I think that's in part because you have an ownership that doesn't seem to have any real understanding of journalism and the imperatives there. They got rid of some very distinguished journalists over the years. But you're also seeing, you know, this is a very thin news weekly at this point.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the finances of the very industry are just under assault. Hard to do at the same time the management of the company's integrity is very much in doubt.
Well, that's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you so much.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Agnes Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.